Well, hello, you're listening to Big Mouth, and my name's Andrew Harrison, and you can probably tell from the background noise and interference that we are actually at the Glastonbury Festival. We are literally live or recording. I have a couple of special guests with me. One of them is a pre-existing podcast guest and friend of the podcast, Ian Harrison, a news editor of Mojo Magazine. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
He's got to come in partly because he knows what's going on at Glastonbury, also because he's my brother, so he has got no excuse to say no.
This is true.
Also, we have a Big Mouth debutante, which is Roy Wilkinson, ex of Sounds and ex of Select Magazine, and also the writer of the excellent British Sea Power memoir, Do It For Your Mum.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Are you enjoying the Glastonbury Festival?
Overall, I would say yes.
Now, this is the first time you've been about 10 years, isn't it?
Yeah, for a little bit of historical perspective. Now, the first time I came to Glastonbury was in 1985.
Right.
And then I would, at a guess, which is just my own approximation, I think of it as like 60,000 people.
Yeah.
How many is there here today? Like 250,000?
I think it's something about 180,000 nowadays.
Okay.
I mean, I think since they've been able to cut back on people just digging tunnels and jumping over fences and stuff like that.
Yes.
But I think it has got over 220,000 in the past.
Okay.
But it's certainly bigger than it was in 1985.
It seems immense to me. I'm most used to going to smaller festivals like End of the Road, a couple of festivals in Cornwall, Port Elliot, and a wonderful new one where I live in South Devon. New one started last year called Sea Change, which were between like 3,000 and 10,000.
Yeah.
So this one seems good, but somewhat overwhelming.
Yes, it's actually bigger than the towns that some people live in.
Yes.
And it actually has better facilities than the towns that some people live in.
It certainly does.
Ian, what's been your favourite bit so far?
Well, I mean, the obvious thing to say is there isn't a quagmire out there. There isn't deep, you know, pools everywhere.
Yeah, it's quite dry.
It's very dry. It's dusty and dry. You can get everywhere with great ease. And that is, you know, that is key, because then, you know, it will open itself up much more easily.
Last year was grim for two reasons. One was it was a bit wet and a bit muddy, and also the monstrous spectre of Brexit.
Oh, I know, yeah.
Was over the whole.
I know. But we're used to that now. We're used to that, you know, feeling of misery. So you come here, and it's doubly important that you do enjoy yourself and forget the cares of the outside world.
Well, I think we've been freed of the cares of the outside world, the misery.
I would say so, definitely.
Things that have been good, we've seen. Now, we saw the opening act on the other stage, The Pretenders with Chrissie Hynde, which I thought was actually an actual Glastonbury classic.
It was moment.
So fantastic.
Yeah.
She was brilliant.
She was.
And she had the hubris and the chutzpah to open with a couple of new ones and
she
then
did.
Do the singles.
Yeah, that was fine. But when they came, it was, you know, it's mad because, you know these songs deeply anyway, to hear them played again by someone who is, you know, still obviously on it in a big way.
Yeah.
And looks great, sounds great, just thinking, you know. Brilliant. It is heartwarming.
She was thanking the audience for the walk whistles as well, wasn't
she?
Yeah,
she was, yeah.
And, but, I mean, to me, what really stuck out on that one was that Chrissie Hynde probably hasn't had her due credit over the years. Because the songs are incredible songs.
True.
And the fact that you've got a bunch of 20-year-old people.
That's true.
Who know them.
That is true. They sang along to all of it. I don't know, but I mean, I mean she only makes a record, doesn't she? She's not, you know, makes a record once every, you know, few years.
Yeah.
I'm not. Do you think she minds? I think she's probably someone who's very secure in herself, really.
Yeah.
She knows what she's done, and she's, you know.
But she's not the kind of person who's on the cover of a magazine every 5 minutes.
This is true.
And she's not. She would not be accorded status in the canon, would she? She probably shouldn't be.
Maybe that's because she's still making records. Yeah. She hasn't stopped yet.
I've been left fallow, kind of thing.
Yeah.
It was particularly heartening and kind of pleasant to see all these 20-year-olds that, like, knew the words to Brass in Pocket.
I know, it was great, wasn't it?
Knew the words to Message of Love, but Don't Get Me Wrong.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's it, Him to Her, that song.
Yeah.
Which is, that was just such an amazing performance.
Yeah.
You know, it was, you know, properly emotional.
Yeah.
And she did it so well.
Yeah.
You know, I was really impressed by that.
Roy, what's the best thing you've been seeing?
Well, I caught a smidgen of The Pretenders, and I would send a massive salute to Chrissie Hynde. If you're saying she's not in the canon, she probably should be.
Yeah.
Because she's written so many brilliant songs, pop songs. And she has such a wonderful voice.
The
full
voice
of distinctiveness, charm, sensuality.
But I thought
it's a brilliant voice.
It worked particularly well today because it's a voice that doesn't require massive effort. She's not a belter or a bellower, but she has such subtlety and such fantastic inflection. And she had, like, something like, I don't know, 20,000 people absolutely in the park there.
Yeah, first thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was good. That was good.
She was great. No, this week, purely coincidentally, because I didn't know the Pretenders were playing, and I hadn't done this for at least a year, but I played the Pretenders' greatest hits at home. Yes. It sounded fantastic. I was dying to see it today. We got here a bit too late for various reasons, so I saw it like about half an hour, but that was great. My other highlights immediately following her was Charlie XCX on the same stage. She was pretty good.
So this is the young people's music.
Well,
isn't it?
Yeah, it's definitely young. There was a lot of young people in the crowd. Two different modes of assertiveness, Chrissie Hynde and Charlie XCX, both with definite merit. I mean, when she, to be honest, I mean, the songs I know best of hers are hits that she has written for other people. Her big hit, I think you know the title of this one, Andrew, the one about I Don't Care.
I
Love It.
Yeah, by Icona Pop, recorded by Icona Pop. Yeah, she, Icona Pop, I don't know. Yeah.
Otherwise, I think this was quite a common highlight in the vicinity. Was happening upon Nick Turner of Hawkwind.
Well, this is it. We all saw Nick Turner and Friends
because
on the
Mandala
stage.
Because we went
stage.
Down to look at the sort of strange, sustainable gnome house that cost about £300 to build.
Yes.
And then, you know,
this
a strange
is
noise.
House you can live in, isn't it? It's not a gnome house, it's a human house.
It's a human house. But then a strange noise drifted over and we went to have a look and, it's a second man playing a saxophone. Could it be Nick Turner? It was. And I think it's fair to say what we saw that, you know, today will remain with us.
Yeah.
For the rest of our lives.
Because you've got Nick Turner up at the front, sort of just harping the way independently.
I think he's good.
Kind of, you know, can meet hippie, rambling, motoric stuff.
Yeah.
And then this singer that we're not entirely sure who he was gets up and starts giving this amazing stream of consciousness involving, well, I mean, this is a grand-up podcast, so I think we can mention the subject matter. He is, the song was, I've got bats in my scene.
Yes, it was.
And they fly around like ghosts.
I think it referred to very profound psychedelic experiences.
Yeah.
Obviously, as we know, this can lead people to deeper...
Psychosis.
Well, you say psychosis, I would say deeper understandings of...
psychosis and deeper understandings.
Well, all right, well, fair enough. But it was really good. He was like Sid Barrett and Nigel Blackwell, wasn't he?
He was like Sid Barrett and Nigel
Blackwell.
He
was on about Trumpeton as well and Chigley.
Yeah, he was sort of advising people to join the Trumpeton Fire Service, but don't smoke a spliff before you go to
I know.
Trumpeton
Fire Wagon. But he got a really big cheer. I mean, whoever he was.
He might. There's a fire hazard there, isn't there?
There's fire hazard, definitely, yeah. But I mean, was that the most Glastonbury thing you've ever seen?
No, I was so impressed by some of the lyrics that I had to write them down. The one about I've got bats in my semen. When I make love, that's when I see them.
When I see them.
They fly around the room.
Yes.
Like
and it was
dove.
A kind of stream of consciousness.
Yes, yes.
Which lasted over about 20 minutes.
It did, it was long.
And
yes.
We should say that this Nick Turner performance was 3 hours long.
Yeah, well, it's Nick Turner of Hawkwind
and
Friends.
Yeah.
And it was billed for a 3-hour thing. I think in 3 hours they got through about four songs, perhaps.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and another thing, I mean, you know, you say, who you saw this band, what was it like? Now, you might say that originally the singer with Nick Turner was striking looking. I mean, I don't know actually who it was, but, you know, I think he might be a Hawkwind, you know, regular. And he's wearing a black miniskirt, you know. Was it
a chap in a black miniskirt.
Yeah, leather. Yeah. Now, people might comment on this, but I think within the context of it, you just didn't. Because I think Nick Turner and Friends, they've been coming here for a long time, you know.
Yeah.
They are...
Well, it's their place, not ours.
Exactly.
And you need to fit in.
Yeah.
Are you ever,
and it is a very liberated place.
It's a very liberated place. Are you ever too old to go to Glastonbury?
No. But we went to see Alternate.
Yes, we did. We went to see Alternate. Brilliant Alternate. Who have had it's just Mark Archer now, had a renaissance over the past couple of years. And he was on in the Spaceport, which is a space-themed cocktail bar.
Yeah.
And he played, basically...
Very Blake 7.
It was amazingly Blake 7, down to the typography.
Yeah.
And he played, basically, not just all the best ear-bleeding hits of rave from 91 to 93, but he played them in sort of 45-second excerpts, didn't he?
Yeah.
You've got a little bit of Cybersonic.
Oh, yeah, there's no chance of getting bored.
Charlie,
and the
you know,
there.
By the Prodigy, and then a little bit of James Brown is Dead.
Yeah.
And a little bit, it's all
did I hear a bit of it, Lock Up by Zero B?
Probably,
yeah.
Almost certainly,
I did.
Yeah. Roy was poking me in the ribs going, do you know these songs?
Yeah, you've now got a lot of them.
Absolutely, I know quite, they're all on the Reactivate compilation.
It's very good. And also, we cannot not mention Chris Christopherson.
Well, yes, we went to see Chris Christopherson, and it was a remarkable thing, wasn't it? Because clearly his voice is not what it was, but people were willing him.
He is 81 years old.
Yeah.
And it often is the case with people voicing them, but they can still, you know, they're willed on, and they're playing to an appreciative audience.
Yeah.
Then they will do it, they will pull it off, and he definitely did. And Johnny Depp came on, which
was
exciting.
Depp came on, and very theatrically just like twanged a string here and there. He clearly wasn't properly playing, was he? Uh-huh. He was doing rock star shapes.
I have no idea. I mean, I was watching Chris Christopherson.
Well, there you go.
Because he played this Sunday morning coming down, didn't he? And he played, you know, How They Make It Through the Night. And yeah, if you're 81, these songs are going to have an extra, you know, aren't they?
They are, and I mean, because you know, we're now running into the era of great sort of rock, country, pop performers.
Yeah.
Died of old age, not dying.
Well, it reminded me a little bit of Bert Bacharach, which was either last year or the year before.
Yeah.
And you know, Bert Bacharach is obviously advanced in years.
Yes.
And he's probably touring with a more reduced, you know, setup than we would expect. You know, somebody's playing string parts on a keyboard, basically. You know?
Yeah.
But
where's my 60-piece orchestra?
It was still great, you know.
Yeah.
And you could tell Bert was, you know, kind of moved by it.
Ian, what's been the best thing that you've seen at Glastonbury
in your time?
I've seen
so many good things at Glastonbury. I mean, I think coming, you know, when you're a bit younger, say, it's always going to have an extra golden glow about it. And I think the early 90s were just, you know, like great, great, great years. You know, that sort of 93 to 95 were great. And then had a year off, and then it was muddy. But I've kept on coming back. Yeah. So, you know, obviously, you know, it's still doing whatever it does. I think Bowie in the year 2000 was pretty special.
That was astonishing. That was the same weekend that the Pet Shop Boys were on with and they got Kerris Matthews to come on and do the Dusty Springfield parts, which is quite remarkable.
But saying that, there's been tons of stuff, hasn't there? I mean, how do you pick one?
Well, I mean, I will always be particularly fond.
You're going to say Orbital?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it was like I had to drag a bunch of people to see Orbital, and they loved it.
Yeah.
But this was one of those rare occasions when you see a load of people discovering a completely new kind of music that they previously would never have given daylight to and loved it. I mean, the stuff was so new, even I didn't know it.
Yeah.
And I'm a big nerd for Orbital. And this was stuff that was on the new album that wasn't out yet.
Yeah.
You've got a sun-baked field full of people hearing a gigantic voice go, "What does God?"
I know, it was great, that was.
All freaked out to the core. Roy, have you seen similar turning points here, similar special bits?
Well, if I had to name, just thinking about this, if I had to name a favourite Glastonbury turn, actually thinking about, I don't think I've seen any many greats in the sense of Bowie or Bert Bacharach, we were talking about earlier. The one that comes to mind would be New Order in 1987, I think. And what they were headlining on the main stage, and what it was a good, it was a good set. What is the thing that sticks in the mind is how kind of like amateurish it was. It was
the
exhilarating.
Show,
themselves, their performance. It was like Barney was like that. These were the days when Barney would just get routinely very drunk. I think he's quite self conscious about his singing.
Yeah,
and his answer to this was to get quite drunk. I think on Perno. He was I saw him getting drunk before a bit.
Yeah.
And when he came on, he was, I think it's fair to say, he was fairly plastered.
Yeah.
The show was kind of exhilarating, but he had a kind of like a extended finale, which consisted of Barney being kind of petulant. It was a massive, if I remember correctly, it was a massive extended version of the Velvet Underground's Sister Ray. And Barney trashing his little Vox amplifier, leading it around like a bit like a maltreated version of Canine, sort of leading it around on a lead and sort of smashing it about the stage. And it was just kind of like, I can't imagine anyone playing on that stage now and being so kind of like almost parochial in a way, a sort of parochial brilliance. So I think things have changed since then.
Tend to get the grand choreographed sort of big moments with sort of like full video syncs and dancers and all the rest of it. But then, you know, that's pyramid stage behaviour, isn't it? When you get to the smaller stages, you see astonishing and ridiculous things going on. So what do we think? I mean, obviously, each year of Glastonbury develops its own character, and some years we think, oh, that was the money year, or that was the amazing, beautiful year with this one. What will be the character of this year, do you think? How's it going to go down in the annals?
It hasn't happened yet, so I'm not quite sure. I think it'll go down as the year when everyone was just really happy. It wasn't muddy.
Yeah.
You know, that is going to, you know, make such a massive difference. It's a really boring answer, but, you know.
Well, yeah, I mean, I suppose it's fair to say, I don't think anybody would say this is a vintage lineup. It's no. not like this is, oh my God, I can't believe it.
But I mean, there are loads of things there. You just got to punt them out a bit more, maybe. You know, yes. There's no way you're not going to enjoy it. You will. You'll have just as good a time as you always do.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, well, it's Friday night, and we're going to go and see Radiohead, I think, and then other things. You've got your eye on Major Lazer, haven't you?
Possibly.
Who else have you got your eye on?
Things I don't know about yet.
Okay, right. Roy, have you got your eye on things?
Yeah, Lord.
Lord.
Sleeping Mods.
Yes.
Status Quo Acoustic, also
Aquostic.
Known as Aquostic.
Aquostic.
And I might go and see a bit of Flaming Lips, because they always... Yeah. I was just thinking about this. Of anyone who's playing here at Glastonbury this weekend, Wayne Coyne might have put the most thought into it.
Yeah, he's very meticulous.
They were dead good. He played the other stage one year, didn't they? And that was fantastic.
With the Zorbs and the Orbs.
Yeah. It's just delivered on every possible level.
Yeah.
Marvellous.
Yeah. But look, it's Friday night. We're going to go get our act together, go and see what happens. So we're going to have a little bit of music here to bridge the gap. And we'll, after this record, you'll hear a report from Saturday afternoon. Day two, and we're still at the Glastonbury Festival, and I have another exciting guest with me, which is Danny Eccleston of Mojo Magazine, formerly editor of Q Magazine, and now deputy editor of Mojo. What's your official title?
Senior editor, which is funny because, of course, we're all senior.
Yes.
Yeah.
There are no junior editors.
I'm not even the most senior. I'm practically the new boy there, having only worked there for 10 years.
Right, okay. So that, you're kind of on probation, aren't
you? I am, yeah. They could sack me at any time.
Do they still sort of take your dinner money and bog wash you on the way into work?
Yes, but
as the apprentice,
I do. Sometimes they bring me in sandwiches, so that's nice.
Yeah. God. So how's your Glastonbury going so far?
It's going really, really well. Primarily, I'm here because Radiohead are playing.
Yes.
And they are like my ultimate super fan band.
Yep.
And probably
know all the B-sides kind of guy.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. They're the band that I stand up drunkenly and say, this is one of the great rock bands of all time, and easily the best rock band of the last 20 years.
Okay.
And then people go, you're drunk.
Shut up, Dan.
Yeah, shut up. Exactly.
Well, I have two questions to ask you. And the first one is obviously, how did you think of it last night? But the other is, there seems to be an annual British tradition now. Whenever last time we play a big event, whenever Radiohead play a big event, there's a massive discussion on social media about are they brilliant or are they crap? There doesn't seem to be any intermediate ground. But mostly, why does everybody like this prog band? They're obviously a prog band. Why don't they like King Crimson and Pink Floyd? What's the matter with them? They only like Radiohead because they've got this imprimatur of him. So, question one, Minister. Were they any good last night? Did you enjoy it?
They were terrific. That's one of the best Radiohead sets I've ever seen.
Yes.
I heard a lot of stuff immediately after the show from certain broadsheet journalists who I bumped into afterwards. And there was lots of talk about whether the beginning of the show was a bit too kind of fanny, a bit too kind of weird and inaccessible, and then they got to the hits and then it was good.
Yes.
But obviously I have a completely different view, which is that they were fantastic from start to finish. And I loved the fact, actually, that the first 10 minutes of the show, which I wouldn't have said was inaccessible, but was certainly representative of the full range of what Radiohead can do. But luckily, the people that stood around me who were being idiots and talking nonsense and shouting and being obviously not Radiohead fans left after about 10 minutes, and leaving people like me who were super into it.
Who were really into it.
Yeah, and I think we, there was something there. There's something there in all of Radiohead's phases. I like the fact that the electronica stuff that they do, which not everybody kind of loves, but I think that when it's on stage, you really get it. And there were lots of stuff like that I thought that, there are obviously songs like Fake Plastic Trees that people just went mad for. But I think that also you could sense people going, I don't know this song very well, but I really like it.
Partly because I'm pissed.
Well, I think that it did peak a lot of people's chemical kind of balances, I think. So that was good. But I think that the other thing I think is that it felt to me that indicative of that issue around festival sets which is how ingratiating are you going to be?
Yeah.
How much more ingratiating are you going to be than you would normally if you were just playing a normal gig to your normal set of fans? And I think there's a balance to be struck, because obviously you don't necessarily want to go and see a band at a festival, even one that you really like, and they unveil their jazz odyssey.
Yeah.
You know, and you just get, for very good reasons, bands, even very well-known ones, who are very comfortable in their status, don't generally do that at festivals. But there's the other extreme of being over-ingratiating. Now, I saw the Elbow surprise set at the Park yesterday, and I think that sometimes, bless him, Guy Garvey really does err on the side of over-ingratiating.
Right.
And he really was pulling out all the stops yesterday, almost because they were a surprise act. It was like, you know, because it's such a thing around the culture of Glastonbury to have a surprise slot.
Yeah.
It was like, here we are, you know. It's, you know, there was a kind of sense of kind of entitlement and kind of an ingratiation at the same time. Lots of, like, instructing the crowd to do, waving their hands from side to side.
Yeah.
Which I always think is, like, up to the crowd, whether they want to wave their hands.
Unless it's hip-hop, in which case all the ladies do this, all the fellas do that. It's kind of mandatory.
Yes, it's mandatory, absolutely. So, you know, a good set by Elbow. But for me, you know, I like a band to force me to come to them a bit.
Do you want them to treat you a bit mean and keep you keen?
Yes, I do. And I think that's kind of me as a... basically a post-punk person, you know. That's what I expect. I expect to be gobbed on and kind of kicked in the face a bit.
You've been to
and
a post-punk postcard fair,
exactly,
yeah.
That's what I like.
Well, you mentioned there was a crowd of annoying idiots in front of you who kept talking and shouting during Radiohead. I had a crowd of people jumping around and shouting in front of me at Radiohead, and it was Matt Smith, Doctor Who, and Sienna Miller, and their mates. And I was just, because I'm a big Doctor Who nerd, I was just like, I love you. They were genuinely really, really into it. I think they'd had a very exciting day, and they looked very excited.
Yes.
Sienna Miller's on Matt Smith's shoulders and all the rest of it. It's like, if I had a camera on me, it could have made a few bob out of this.
Absolutely.
You know, for Heat magazine or something like that, you know. I offered Matt Smith a drink from my summer cocktail bottle, and he very kindly declined, possibly thinking I was from the Daily Mail trying to stitch him up with a bottle of drugs or something like that. So getting back to that question I asked a while ago, Radiohead, why do people sort of reject and shun actual prog and love Radiohead even though they are basically a prog band?
Well, it's an interesting question. Obviously, as senior editor of Mojo magazine, I embrace prog. I don't see any...
you reject the premise of the question.
Yeah, well, I don't reject the premise of the question because I know what you mean. There are probably more people ready to go mad at a Radiohead show than there are people ready to go mad at a King Crimson show, although the recent King Crimson shows they did were fantastic. And the progness of Radiohead isn't a problem for me, and certainly at one point last night I just realised actually it's gone quite jazz rock fusion, actually. It's gone beyond prog.
Well, when everything's in 13/12 time.
Yes.
Yeah, and pentatonics, three different pentatonic scales that don't fit.
And of course, they've got the two drummers now. You know, they've got Phil Selway, and then they've got Colin Deamer from Get the Blessing, who's also like one of those guys that you can turn to say, I really want somebody to do live drums that sounds just like dubstep.
Yeah.
Which is impossible to do, because no drummer can do that, because it's really difficult, which is why you program a machine to do it.
Yeah.
But he can do it. He's like Jackie Leibowitz. You know, he's a genius. And I think that that element of what they do now, that sophistication, is what's kind of pushing them on. And they never stop writing songs, either. Great tunes, but drawing in all these incredibly diverse musical influences. You know, sometimes you go and see a band and they're performing or playing, they're playing their tunes for you, which is great. But generally when I go to see Radiohead, I have that sense of music being created in front of me. And that's what I get most of a kick about in music.
Glastonbury being a big place for them, it's always really striking and kind of cheering to see what could be quite a laddish audience actually singing along to these very strange and abstruse and unusual and oddly constructed records, because they clearly mean a lot to people.
Yes.
I mean, they might not have a bloody clue what they're about, but that doesn't matter, because you invest these songs in their own meaning, don't you?
Well, the incredible thing about Radiohead, I think, is that one of the incredible things, I say everything's an incredible thing, I think some people think they're big kind of soft, you know, slow tunes. I think they think that they're in some way meant to be happy.
Yeah.
Whereas in fact, you know, obviously generally they're all about alienation.
Yeah.
No, I find the alienation quite warming, you know, because it's like, oh, so other people feel like that too. And maybe I'm underestimating the kind of the general rock audience. Maybe they're not just responding to some chord changes that make them feel nice. They are kind of absorbing the fact that you know, here's somebody who's troubled, and maybe this is an experience that they can relate to.
That's sort of Radiohead. What about other things? Did you see J. Corbs?
I did see Corbyn, and do you know what? I think it actually plays to my thesis about ingratiation versus...
Well, he certainly played the hits, didn't he? Bad things are bad and good things are good.
Yes.
Let's have more good things and fewer bad things.
I'm a big Corbyn fan, like Radiohead. Right. Corbyn fan, voted Labour. Emily Thornberry is my MP. But I think it's a dangerous moment for him, where I think that there's a temptation for him to start offering a panacea for everything, for all the world's ills. And that's kind of what I heard out today. It was cake and poetry for everybody.
Yeah, well,
and I think that he needs to stay focused at this point in time, because if he kind of just keeps on hitting the specifics about how things are in this country right now, I think he'll continue to build.
So he's basically, he's doing his Definitely Maybe Now. He's about to do his Morning Glory, but let's be honest, there's going to be a Be Here Now around the corner at some point.
He should be careful of the Be Here Now.
Yeah. See, I'm an enormous Corbyn sceptic. I get the fact that he's a fantastic campaigner, and that his weird kind of anti-charisma of just being your granddad really plays well, particularly with the youth. And you know, this place is absolutely festooned with young people in Nike knockoff Corbyn t-shirts and Run DMC knockoff Corbyn t-shirts. They absolutely love him.
Yeah.
I am really worried that the idea that politics is being determined by the mechanics of pop music, where you love a star and you invest in what that star is all about, because politics ought to be boring. It ought to be about, you know, ideas and programs and costing and so forth. It shouldn't be about, hey, I love you, man.
Well, there's a danger in anything being black and white or red and blue, and I think that his speech today was very much about how everybody here at Glastonbury is kind of pushing towards the same goal of you know, world justice and all-round niceness, but it's just not the case, you know. There's a sizable portion of the people here who are just getting off their face, and there's another proportion of people, as I know them, at least two of the people I came with are Tory voters and not interested in Jeremy Corbyn whatsoever. So you can overplay the idea of Glastonbury, even though there have been these headline commitments over the years, which I support wholeheartedly, about Greenpeace, about ecology, about justice across the world, etc. And obviously it's a brilliant forum for all those ideas, and he did touch on that, but I'd be careful about imagining it being a movement.
But it's very Glastonbury. I mean, we can see from where we're sitting in the backstage area, there's an old poster of the Glastonbury 1983 CND Festival, when you were guaranteed a speech from Monsignor Bruce Kent and possibly Hugh Masekela would play. You know, it's old school NME 1980s politics.
Well, that's
resurged.
Yes. Yes. Well, it's also an indication, as you say, at how things have changed. You know, Glastonbury is not the cottage industry it once was. You know, and, you know, there's been a, you know, issue over recent years of mismatch between the founding values of the festival and the more corporate, big music.
The necessities kind of running an enormous event like this, which means you do need to have sponsors and a chill and charge tent and things like that.
It's just got bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger.
Yeah.
And obviously it makes more and more and more and more money. And obviously we know a lot of that money goes to good causes, which is fantastic. But it also means you bring people into your tent quite literally. Into your tent that, you know, you wouldn't normally maybe play ball with. So So, yeah, it's complicated. And it's interesting, you know, I haven't seen a politician come here and be welcomed in that way for quite a long time. It's not the same as having, like, a culture minister turn up on stage yeah. and be ignored, which yeah. I've seen on many Glastonbury's
so far. Mud thrown at them, yes, kind of thing. Well, what about music, then? Tell us things you've seen that surprised you, that you weren't expecting to be good, that were good.
Well, I'd never seen Moon Landings. I yeah. love their record. I'm a big fan of Liam from Fat White Family and Fat White Family generally, and I expected them to deliver something unusual, so that's why I went. That was at the Park Stage earlier, and they really did deliver. So Liam came on, the singer came on, and he kind of cling filmed kind of a box to his head, and he painted a red stripe down the middle of his face that went down his body like he'd kind of painted his own Ajax strip okay. onto him, and then he proceeded to smoke the same rolled up cigarette for the bulk of the show. He's got fantastic, like, glamorous female co-singer, and some, like, fantastic old blokes playing vintage keyboards. And there's a sense of, if any of your podcast listeners remember the glory that was Earl Brutus.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. It smacked to me. It had air of Brutus around it.
Ooh. Ode to Brutus.
Ode to Brutus, yeah, beautiful. Exactly. Brute 66.
Brute 66, yeah. God. That sounds good. Well, I mean, the thing that surprised me, we were wandering around by the West Holt stage, and there was this trio on, and I've got to even look up their name in the little thing around my neck. Crombing, I don't know what it, but they basically seemed to be from Texas, and they were playing music that made Albatross by Fleetwood Mac sound like two pints of lager and a packet of crisps, please. Unimaginably laid back and mellow, with a lot of quality patter, sort of, you know, super soul, but from an utterly horizontal and reclined position. They have a female bass player who is enormously well turned out, shall we say. Yes. A really striking stage presence, which brought a lot of blokes to the stage. But it was a beautiful, amazing thing to just stumble upon. And I'll certainly be streaming at least one or two tracks when I get back home. Just because, you know, it was one of those great moments where you're wandering around and something just jumps on you and you're transfixed. So I'm standing there with my Goan fish curry for breakfast, being totally vibed by this trio who are apparently from Texas.
Well, it's a cliche, isn't it, about Glastonbury that, you know, all music is here. And yeah. I remember when I was much younger, the first few times I came here, I was just looking for indie guitar music. And every now and again, you know, I would investigate something else. But over the years, it's been a big part of my education about music, about dropping some of my prejudices about things that I thought I liked and thought I didn't like. And, you know, I think Glastonbury introduced me to dance music. I wasn't one of those people down at Shoom, you know,
taking
early
an
doors.
Ecstasy pellet.
No, no,
yes.
In early doors, you know, that really came to me, you know, during the 90s rather than in the later 80s. And Glastonbury certainly was a part of that, and showed me how idiotic I'd been in terms of writing off this music, or just leaving it over there and not looking to investigate it. You know, reggae, African music,
I remember
jazz, you know, lots of things I've seen here that have really broadened my mind over the years.
Yeah. I remember in the mid-90s when I was editing Select, and we were trying to squeeze as much dance music into the indie magazine as we could. We were down the corridor from Q magazine, when Q was very much in its Simply Red, you know, stick with Terence Trent D'Arby phase.
Yes.
You know, it was a brilliant magazine, but it didn't forge ahead.
Mm-hmm.
And John Baldy, the late, wonderful John Baldy, a lovely bloke, whenever Andrew Collins used to put any dance music, or even the Aphex Twin, he used to say, "What is this fax machine music you are playing in the office? Put Bob Dylan on."
Yeah.
And, you know, it seems, you know, when you get to my age, the 90s seem terribly recent, you know, but actually it was, there was a huge schism in music, wasn't there?
Absolutely.
Not like now, where we all like everything all the time.
Well, you know, there are good things and bad things about that, aren't there? I think that people, I do miss some kind of more critical thinking and talking about music. And sometimes that only comes from taking positions that are antithetical. You know, you don't have a synthesis unless you have a thesis and antithesis.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think we're lacking a bit of thesis antithesis at the moment. We're all music is great.
Well, you know, what? I'm going to... here's a music that's not great. We were wandering across the other stage today, and a band called Whitney were on, who appear to be very much in the Vice, Pitchfork kind of NME shallow end thing. Like, they're sort of, you know, bunch of skinny sort of, you know, possibly Californian people. And all we caught was, they had a singing drummer as well, which is never a good idea in my book. All we caught was a song called No Woman, where this guy is singing about how he hasn't got a girlfriend. And the music was so flaccid, and the delivery was so weak and wet, and the vocals were so whimpering. And I just thought, well, no wonder you haven't got a girlfriend, mate, if this is the song that you're making about it. So there is something out there.
Brilliant, there's like, some rubbish
there's
music.
There's some rubbish out there. Just before we close this little section, I'll let you get on with your evening. What's been your worst Glastonbury experience, Dan?
Oh, God. Well, Mud, I suppose, has been the
defining...
They're
great. Didn't they not do Tiger Feet?
Very good. Have you used that one before?
No.
Every year.
I never use it again. Right. So, Mud.
If only.
Yes.
If only. No, Mud generally. 97 was a kind of, although a great year, Radiohead were fantastic. Yeah. 20 year ago today.
20 years of the Mud apocalypse.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, that was awful. And more recently, as I've got older, I found the Mud harder to kind of really come to terms with. I won't go into any kind of,
personal misadventures.
Personal misadventures, just in case my mother listens to this
yes.
podcast.
this one's going out to you, you know what, Mrs. Danny's mum.
I haven't really had terrible times. No, but that was one thing. I remember seeing the Verve one year, and their amps broke down. Or the guitarist amp broke down, and the rest of them kind of just constructed this kind of groove on a completely different song because the guitarist couldn't do his stuff, and I remember Richard Ashcroft going, and we can do this because we're musicians, and then Nick McCabe,
debatable, yes,
Nick McCabe's amp came back on, he comes in, and it's and it just felt like a kind of improvisational moment of brilliance that was occurring in front of my eyes. And that's what I look for at Glastonbury, and that's why it's not like really like any other festival.
That is true. What are you going to do tonight then?
We might be glading, probably a bit of Sasha and Digweed. Maybe I really want to see. I'm not sure about Foo Fighters. I don't love them. I want to see Solange.
Yes,
but that might. Oh, thing I really, really want to see and looking forward to, Songhoi Blues. They are a Malian band.
Yeah.
And I think even I, who likes a lot of the old Malian desert blues stuff, like Tanariwen and Tammy Crest, other bands beginning with T, I thought that I'd run out of interest in hearing another one of those groups. But Songhoi Blues are just they're a younger generation of Malian musicians, so they still kind of love the Jimi Hendrix and have the kind of Malian groove to them, but they're much more in your face punk rock, like, or a kind of like really gnarly mid 60s R&B group.
Gnarly
like,
Mali.
Gnarly
it's
Mali.
Gnarly Mali.
Oh, I love it.
Excellent.
Love it. Very good.
Okay, well, you've sold me, so I may well accompany you on that one.
Fantastic. Well, I'm 7:30
up
at the park.
Well, maybe we should have a bit of a listen to it. So here is something from Bite, Songhoi Blues. Things are winding down and there's a beautiful sunset happening here, and I'm in the backstage area with Eve Barlow, formerly of Enemy Inc. and now the basically the LA correspondent of the Sunday Times and numerous other things. Come over here, especially if you can only see how sparkly and glittery her face is, you'd be delighted. How are you, Eve?
I got this sparkle done yesterday, Andrew, and it has
and you haven't washed it off.
It's stayed intact.
Well,
look, I'm not going to tell you about my hygiene kind of routine at Glastonbury, but it allows for glitter to stay on my face overnight.
Okay, fantastic.
Yes,
you basically sleep standing up and hope for the best.
Yeah, basically, I mean, sleep, is that involved?
Sleep in inverted commas.
Yes, absolutely. In inverted commas, precisely, yes. My Glastonbury is really great. You know, last year I actually found the site quite difficult, and I know some people that, for the first time, this is my, I've got an anniversary year this year, so this is my 10th anniversary.
The 10th Glastonbury.
My 10th.
That's like paper or copper or something.
Something crap. But anyway, last year was the first time that I left the site thinking, like, can I do this again? The site was really thick to walk through, and it was just quite, you know, unpleasurable. Yes. So it was hard, but I make my annual pilgrimage every year, and tonight is going to be even harder to leave because we know that it's a fallow year next year.
Yes.
And it's going to be a whole 2 years till we all congregate again.
Yeah.
And it's a bit like, oh goodness, what's life going to look like in 2 years' time?
Because if you look like life 2 years ago, and it feels like another planet, so God knows what.
Andrew, I'll probably still have this on my face.
Probably will, yeah. Also with us, because it's a very international section of the podcast, we have top producer and Spotify man, Tom Calderon. Hello, Tom. How are you?
Good to see you. And I just want to say one thing. I know people can't see this, but I have to wear very dark sunglasses because Eve's face just blinds you from the sun with that shiny thing. So I apologize. It's not because I'm a superstar Hollywood guy. Just it's from her face. Just so you know.
And you're also a long-time Glastonbury person, are you not?
Yeah, I'm with Eve, actually. I didn't realize that. 10 years for me as well.
Yeah.
And what I love about it is I feel like I'm a bit off the grid. I get to see some good friends, particularly, you know, around the industry and everything. But it's also one of those places you can get lost and just discover music, which is why we're all in this in the beginning anyway.
Yeah, you know? Well, I mean, it's been described to me as the Great British Walking Holiday.
Yeah.
A lot of walking done. You don't really necessarily know where you're going, but when you get there, you know you've arrived.
I look at it, too, like almost like the British version of a musical petting zoo. You kind of walk in, you see something that looks cool, you kind of play with it a little bit and go, I like that, and then move on to the next one.
Mm-hmm.
So I always get a chance to not only discover things. This is probably the first time, though, I have to say, that the headliners were more appealing to me than in past years, because normally I'm always searching out the other places, and this year, particularly Foo Fighters, I really enjoyed, and I thought they did a great job last night.
Yeah. Did you see Barry Gibb?
I did pop by to see him, just because the Legends stage, you need to at least pay homage to that.
Yeah.
Dolly was my favorite, and then next to...
I'm sorry, but I have to interject, because... Just because it's happening on the Pyramid stage doesn't mean it's the only Legends slot that's happening.
Okay. Legends are available.
Other Legends are available. On Wes Holtz, at the same time as Barry Gibb, was Shaggy.
Well, I thought the end was Shaggy.
Yep.
I missed O Carolina, but I did catch a bit of Shaggy.
I did not miss any part of Shaggy.
Okay.
I saw all of Shaggy.
You got the whole Shaggy.
Including Mr. Boombastic.
Okay.
O Carolina, you know, wasn't me.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yep. All right.
I want to register like a little moment on the Barry Gibb side, because it, for me, I mean, I've been coming to Glastonbury since 1987, and it was one of the most astonishing things I've seen. He was on the brink of tears for the reception that he got. And I know that there's a traditional afternoon, Sunday afternoon, it's an old guy, maybe it'll be a little bit ironic. This was not ironic at all. This was beautifully crafted songs, and I don't think he really understood how well they'd be received. I mean, he couldn't finish. You know, a couple of tunes, because he was so taken aback.
Really?
And it was really, really touching.
Do you know, one of the things that's probably not on many people's radar, but yesterday morning the person that opened the John Peel stage was Maggie Rogers.
Yeah.
And she's this new NYU graduate from New York. The story is very much orchestrated around this video on YouTube of her in a seminar at NYU, and Pharrell Williams is coming in to meet some of the music students, and she does her performance of her song Alaska, and you just see Pharrell Williams' face. Suddenly he's like discovered something that he's never seen before, and he's just, you know, he knows immediately that she's got this talent. So that's her story. But she opened the John Peel stage yesterday morning, and she had quite a big crowd. And at the very end of it, I mean, she must have played for about 45, 50 minutes. At the very end of it, she had such a rapturous applause. I would say that almost if everyone in the John Peel stage was sitting down, it would have been the equivalent of like a standing ovation. And she just stood still among the crowd and just looked out at them for about a good, I want to say 2.5 minutes, and really took it in, and you could see it in her eyes. And I don't see many breakthrough artists really taking that time to recognize the kind of moment that they're having, you know.
Well, Solange did a little bit of that for myself as well, because I think she realized that she'd kind of hit a bit of a spot there, and there was a lot of silent standing and absorbing the amazingness while everybody screamed and went crazy, which is terribly affecting. You know, when you see somebody, when their career is taking a bit of an inflection point, it's actually quite exciting, isn't it?
Yeah.
I want to ask you, Tom, why can't America do this kind of thing, do you think? I mean, there's Coachella, and we've all seen the pictures. You guys have been, I've never been.
Never been to Coachella.
Oh, haven't you?
No.
Okay, well,
no interest.
So why can't America do something like this? Okay, obviously there's free range drinking and so forth that America's not really comfortable with, but why can't there be a Glastonbury in America?
Because I don't think any of the festivals that had gone in the States ever started with a place of innocence. It's always started from a place of marketing, frankly. And, you know, look, Lollapalooza in Chicago is very cool because it's in the middle of the U.S. and there's a feeder city, so there's a lot of people that don't get a chance to see these bands. But there's such a respect and level of politeness, I guess is the best way to put it, when you're here, when people are performing, no one's talking. You know, even like you said, sometimes the ironic part of the legend stage is that you kind of giggle maybe a little bit, but you sit there, and when Dolly Parton performed a couple of years ago and she was telling these 3-minute stories, silence, like no one talked, and just the respect level that the people have for the artists is actually pretty amazing here. That's the one thing that I always take from it. But I just think that there's not been a lot of homegrown festivals from the purest sense that Glastonbury has started with, and a legacy of heritage. Probably Coachella, maybe 15 years old, maybe.
Do you not think that the original spirit of Woodstock was probably quite like this? Because for me, you know,
but it never continued. That was the problem.
The funny thing for me is because now I'm a freelance journalist in America, I mostly go to US festivals. And I had this really funny moment that I kept telling people about on site this weekend. On Thursday night when I got here, and I was walking around and going to Shangri-La and wherever I was going, and I kept looking at people that were just like swigging pints of beer around, just walking down the thoroughfares.
Yes.
And I was like, oh my god, this is positively feral. Because
it's normal behavior.
No, it's normal behavior. It's normal.
It's
normal behavior, but I'm so accustomed. I've been so reacclimatized to going to US festivals, and you're locked in these pens, and the pens are specifically for drinking, and then you have to leave them, and you're not allowed to have a glass on site walking around or whatever. Or, you know, like a paper pint or whatever it is.
And here, you're not allowed to not have a drink.
Exactly.
If you haven't got a drink, they have to throw you over the fence.
Exactly. Why are you here?
Yeah.
So I don't know. I think maybe there's something in the infrastructure of the way Americans view how you are respectable at a festival, and they want that kind of extra policing. I don't know if they don't trust people or...
You can't manufacture this. You can't.
Although, would I want to be Captain Downer? I think there is an element where people put their nice hat on at Glastonbury. When they get home, they're just as horrible as ever they were.
Maybe, but at least
they're nice here.
At least they're nice here,
So what's been the best things you've seen over the weekend? What have been your favourite things you've seen?
I mean, for me, frankly, maybe because from the US point of view, seeing Jeremy Corbyn speak yesterday. Yeah, you don't hear that much, that kind of honesty right now. Where we are.
So this is the equivalent of saying Bernie Sanders turn up at what?
Coachella
like
or Bonnaroo, maybe more Bonnaroo because it's a little more earthy.
Yeah.
But having him speak for what, 15 minutes or so, and just not only from the heart, but just it was really fascinating to see that, and it didn't feel out of place and didn't feel like not Glastonbury.
Yeah.
It felt like it belonged.
Yeah, well, I mean, this has got such a heritage of protest, left-wing storm, blah, 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 blah.
Yes.
Hey, Paula, what have been your favourite things?
Okay, my favourite things, I was very fortunate to be side of stage for Katy Perry on the Pyramid stage, which was phenomenal. I don't know why Katy Perry is having such a hard time. I thought she was really brilliant. I love to watch a pop act like that at a festival. I thought Lorde's set was also brilliant in terms of, like, pop production. Stormzy yesterday went completely off and was a really, I felt, a moment of that crossover to the mainstream from the undergrounds, you know?
Those screens were great, by the way. The screens on the stage.
The screens were phenomenal.
Really great.
But my personal favourite moment was, and you're probably predictable for me, Andrew, but Warpaint finally headlined a stage at Glastonbury. They did the park last night. They had a whole new live production with a brilliant light show that was all white, and they were all dressed in these big white baggy overalls. And their front woman, Emily Kokal, was like doing all of her fancy dance moves, and they were absolutely outstanding.
Well, it's going to be a long 2 years.
I know.
It's going to be a long 2 years.
Is it Latitude next year? Is that what we've
done? Latitude's on every year. There was talk. I don't know if it's going to happen or not.
Of a mini Glastonbury thing.
A nano Glastonbury, I don't know.
The bazaar of arts and something in Longleat, apparently. Or the Midlands. I don't know, is Longleat in the Midlands? My geography is terrible.
Listen to you, you're such a Scot. Longleat is not in the Midlands. Longleat is in the south. Longleat is on the 8303 if you go from London to Glastonbury.
Oh,
but you're a Scottish person, so why would you do that? So there's the possibility of that nano Glastonbury. Probably what we'll do this time next year is we'll just sit in a room.
Oh, let's do that, yeah.
Feeling sad.
I was going to feel sad.
I'd be more than happy to do that with you.
I'm going to feel sad. I'm going to listen to everything in its right place and just think, wow, why didn't you put the bangers at the beginning of the set?
But a banger is a very elastic concept in the world of radio. I think we've got completely discussed the podcast there. I'm going to suggest that Matt, back in the studio, if you want to play out with a Barry Gibb song, how about You Don't Know What It's Like? And we'll be back on Big Mouth with normal service with you next week. Now, as the sun goes down and the allure of fields full of cider becomes stronger and stronger, I'm going to send you back to the studio. Thank you. See you all next week.
Baby, you don't know what it's like to love somebody, to love somebody the way I love you.